Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We will begin with the assurances coming from the Taliban that they will not engage in reprisal killings now that they have taken over Afghanistan, but for the area around the Kabul airport, where 6,000 U.S. troops will be guarding the perimeter, inside of which are Western evacuees and desperate Afghans. It is not clear how those outside of the enclave will be able to escape, given that the Taliban surround the area. Joining us to discuss how the killing of bin Laden would have been a good time to declare victory and bring the troops home is Thomas Makaitis, a professor of history at DePaul University, who has taught counterterrorism courses for the past 13 years at venues around the world as part of the U.S. Department of Defense's Counterterrorism Fellowship Program. We will discuss his article at The Hill, Afghanistan's collapse was swift, but it was long in the making, and how, with little debate and congressional oversight, we blindly spent $2 trillion on Afghanistan, which is twice the amount that was hotly debated in the Senate bipartisan infrastructure bill many are celebrating. Then we'll go to the UK to speak with Dr. Sajan Gohil, the International Security Director at the Asia Pacific Foundation, who teaches in the Department of International History at the London School of Economics. He has provided in-depth reports on security issues to the EU, the UNHCR, NATO, the OSCE, and Interpol, and joins us to discuss how the current pragmatism of the Taliban is not to be trusted, and that the 250 to 300 al-Qaeda terrorists in Afghanistan will soon see their numbers swell. Then finally, we'll speak with Brian Concannon, a human rights lawyer and the executive director of Project Blueprint, who is the founder and former director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. He joins us to discuss the devastation caused by Saturday's earthquake, followed by Tropical Storm Grace, and the resignation of the judge overseeing the murder investigation into the assassination of Haiti's President Moïse, whose court clerk showed up dead under suspicious circumstances. And joining us now is Thomas Makaitis, who's a professor of history at DePaul University, who has taught counterterrorism courses for the last 13 years at venues around the world as part of the U.S. Department of Defense's Counterterrorism Fellowship Program. He's the author of 6 books, including New Terrorism, Myths and Reality, and Violent Extremists, Understanding the Domestic and International Terrorist Threat. And he has an article at The Hill, Afghanistan's Collapse Was Swift, But It Was a Long Time in the Making. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Makaitis.
Thank you.
And of course, President Biden's getting slammed from both the left and the right, but he did make a case yesterday on television that he's the president and the buck stops with him. But clearly, there's some kind of intelligence failure happened here, either in the field or in the White House or in the national security community, in terms of not getting these people out in time. Maybe it's bureaucracy. Maybe you've got some answers as to why. I take it that as soon as the U.S. started to withdraw, they lost their intelligence assets in the country. But surely the preparations for what the Taliban have been up to have been long in the making. So let's start with that. What's your sense of, this game blame is going on in the press, so I don't want to pile on, but I wanted to get your opinion.
Yeah. I don't think it's an intelligence failure. I think we knew, it seems as though the White House was very well informed about the degree of the Taliban advance, because that's part of the reason Biden made the decision he did. He said, look, Trump actually, not only did he announce, did he negotiate a withdrawal date, he began to release prisoners, 5,000 of them. He, you know, imposed a ceasefire. And he ran our troop strength down to 2,500 by January 15th before Biden took office. So there was very little that the president could do unless he was willing to surge troops again. And I think he wisely looked at the situation and said, enough is enough, time to move on. Where the failure was I think in the Pentagon's assessment of the quality and the likelihood that the armed forces, the security forces, would perform. They've performed much more poorly than was expected. And I think that's where the failure was. I don't think there was much ignorance as to the Taliban strategy or how effectively they were doing. I mean, in December of 2020 alone, the Afghan National Army abandoned 200 checkpoints in Kandahar province, just in one province. We clearly, the decision of the Trump administration, not only to negotiate, that was fine, but to announce that we were leaving pretty much no matter what, which let the Taliban essentially move into the countryside, especially when we announced a ceasefire to go with the negotiations. They pretty much had free rein, and they quickly overran much of the countryside. They also cut off the crossing points to Iran, Tajikistan, and everywhere else, and really isolated the cities. So once we pulled out in July, those cities were overwhelmed fairly quickly. It doesn't totally explain why the army, virtually collapsed and the government fled as precipitously as it did.
Well, one explanation is that they weren't being fed and the logistics had collapsed and the corruption is completely endemic. And a lot of them are just poor, illiterate country kids.
And I don't blame them for not having faith in their own government, but it also points to a deeper, longer-term systemic failure, and that is that we essentially gave them a military that was created in the image and likeness of the U.S. military with requirement, logistics and requirement that they could not sustain once we left, and an overdependence on air power. Everyone keeps coming back to, well, we drew the air cover. Well, the Taliban doesn't have an air force, and they did extremely well. Yes, corruption is a huge problem and has been from the beginning. And if we might be faulted for not being firmer on making aid contingent on reform. But exactly right. The army, the security forces number about 300,000 on paper. But in reality, they may be as small as 50,000 because many of them are what are called ghost soldiers. They exist on the payroll only so that the commanding officer can collect their pay. They don't exist as real soldiers. And you're absolutely right. Other than the elite special forces, about 10,000 soldiers who fought very hard and very well, most of the others saw little reason to die for a regime in which they had no confidence and which didn't support them.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Makaitis, who's a professor of history at DePaul University, who has taught counterterrorism courses for the past 13 years at venues around the world as part of the U.S. Department of Defense's Counterterrorism Fellowship Program. He's the author of six books, including New Terrorism, Myths and Reality, and Violent Extremists, Understanding the Domestic and International Terrorist Threat. And he has an article at The Hill, Afghanistan's Collapse Was Swift, But It Was a Long Time in the Making. So, plenty to blame to go around. I think you have to give Biden points for at least biting the bullet here, as opposed to his predecessors who kept kicking the can down the road. And and of course, Trump set up this disaster in a way. And I recall the video of Secretary of State Pompeo standing with the Taliban representative in Doha, talking, issuing all kinds of ridiculous assurances. So, and of course, as your article points out, unfortunately, George W. Bush, who got us in there in the first place, was more interested in invading Iraq than in rebuilding Afghanistan. So at the moment, though, it looks as though if you're at the airport there, you maybe will be able to get out. And they've got, well, at the moment, it's not 6,000, but there will be 6,000 U.S. troops in that small perimeter, which they have secured. But it's my understanding is that the Taliban surround them, and if you want to get out of that country, you can't get past the Taliban in order to get into the airport. Is that the situation?
I don't have information on the specific details, but that sounds extremely plausible. On the other hand, it's not in the interest of the Taliban really to interfere with the evacuation, because why create a situation in which the U.S. would use force against you when all we're really doing is planning on pulling out? The challenge, too, is that not all of the individuals rushing to the airport really are likely to be individuals who have a legitimate claim to evacuation, that they were interpreters, that they were U.S. supporters, that they worked with us. It doesn't mean I blame them. I would be doing desperate to get out as well. But it does mean that it's going to be a messy situation to sort out. And there's just this is not a good thing. It's just the least odious of some very undesirable options. And I think that's kind of what we're stuck with. The optics are terrible. And I think you're right. The president at least owned that. But they remind me very much of Saigon in 1975, which I can still remember the images on television from that.
So the Taliban, of course, have had a press conference, and they've been on U.S. cable news, their spokespeople, giving assurances that they're not interested in reprisal killings. But there are reports from Kandahar that they're going door-to-door, hauling people out, killing them, and capturing young 10-year-old girls as brides. Mullah Yaqob, who is the son of Mullah Umar, he's the head of the military commission. He's given instructions that his fighters are not allowed to enter anyone's house, particularly in Kabul, where they have entered recently, and the situation is new. There is no permission to take a car or a house from anyone or anything else. So what do you make of their apparent pragmatism at this moment?
Well, the first thing that we have to say is we're making a mistake if we view the Taliban as a monolithic, highly centralized organization. There's considerable evidence that, in fact, they are a coalition of groups and various other elements. So I think what you're seeing is a genuine desire of those at the top of a very loose pyramid in Kandahar trying to be pragmatic, as you indicated. But the question is, how much do they actually control the behavior of their local commanders on the ground in various parts of the area? There's also a mistake we're making is we assume that, okay, they control Afghanistan. Well, what they've done is oust the Afghan government. It doesn't mean that they've established, you know, governance in the entire territory. This is a deeply fragmented state, which in many respects isn't a state. There are various ethnic groups, Tajiks, Hazaras, Pashtuns being the majority. There are also numerous warlords and so on who control various areas. The Taliban is going to have to work out all kinds of arrangements with these various factions to negotiate how they're actually going to govern. So I'm not surprised we're seeing a very mixed picture. I was looking this morning, there actually apparently were women commentators who were back on one of the Kabul TV stations. So it's not really clear yet how this is going to unfold. I'm, of course, like everyone else, both heartsick and deeply concerned for the status and well-being of women under this kind of regime.
So what role do you think Pakistan has in orchestrating this? Because you could make the case, and many of people I've interviewed who are specialists like Christine Fair, who speaks Urdu and Punjabi and Hindi and was a UN officer there with the assistance mission in Kabul, she's always argued that they're Pakistan's proxies, you know, and that they've consistently stabbed us in the back. So is there a kind of strategy behind this that's where the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence services, are pulling the strings? Because it seems to be too slick for a ragtag bunch of guerrillas with a pretty shaky chain of command.
Well, I think proxy may be too strong, and I emphasize I'm not a regional specialist. I'm a specialist in conflict, counterinsurgency, counterterrorism. But I think they certainly, Pakistan has at the very least made a devil's bargain that once the Taliban were ousted in Afghanistan, they set up shop in the federally administered tribal area. Al-Qaeda operates has its headquarters in Baluchistan, that portion of Pakistan and so on. And the question is, to what degree can the government in Islamabad actually turf them out? And to what is it really worth their time? They're playing a long game. They understand that they knew from the get-go we were not going to be here forever, and they'd have to live with the situation. They were always more comfortable with the Taliban in power than we were, because they did not have to worry then about rear area security in terms of dealing with India, because an Islamist regime like the Taliban was not about to do business with a Hindu one. So you can see that, you know, and yes, it is in their interest to have it go this way. On the other hand, a significant portion of the Pakistani population is Pashtun. And they may find that they've made a devil's bargain. The devil keeps his bargains, but always demands to be paid. And they could easily find this conflict spilling over into their own territory. Whether the ISI is directly involved in providing any kind of direct assistance, I don't know. And I'm outside the U.S. intelligence community, I don't know that anyone does. But there's no question. General Petraeus was on NPR this past week in which he mentioned, rather over the weekend actually, that he said this war is not winnable, but it's manageable. And he indicated the reason it can't be won is exactly what you just said, that as long as the Taliban had safe havens across the border that we could not strike, then it was definitely going to be the case that they had an advantage. And it turned out ultimately to be an insurmountable advantage, as we've seen.
Well, your article points out that on May the 2nd of 2011, the United States Navy SEALs killed bin Laden, and that was a good time to declare victory and bring the troops home.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, Tom, at that moment when the SEALs killed bin Laden, President Obama was speaking at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where he made fun of Donald Trump, who was sitting there in the audience, and talked about his ridiculous TV show. And you could see that Trump was absolutely seething.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people think that that was the moment of humiliation for Trump, where he decided to get back at Obama by mm-hmm. becoming his successor. So I'll leave that for other people to figure out.
Yeah.
But given the casualties, just to wrap up here, in America's longest war, 2,352 U.S. service personnel lost their lives. Another 20,149 suffered injuries, some of them life-altering. Well, a lot of them came from these primitive IEDs, which were basically AMFO, ammonium nitrate, and diesel fuel.
Mm-hmm.
The ammonium nitrate, 100% of it, came from Pakistan.
Yeah.
In Pakistan, you cannot buy the explosive ammonium nitrate for agricultural purposes. They make sure that it's the safe kind. But the explosive version was exclusively sold by the Pakistanis in Afghanistan. And the U.S. military and the Afghans complain, but that seems like a conscious move on my part.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. But the other thing to keep in mind, you know, this is a problem we get into a lot. We tend to mirror, like, well, you know, that we basically have one center of gravity in the United States, and that's the federal government for foreign affairs. When you're dealing with Pakistan, it isn't that simple. You know, you have multiple points in which there are powers. I mean, in some ways, the ISI is a fiefdom within the state. And so, you know, I find that entirely plausible that that was the case. You know, and it's easy in retrospect to say leave, but I can tell you in some reasons why we didn't. General Petraeus was given command along with the surge of troops into Afghanistan under President Obama in 2009. Petraeus was appointed to command in 2010. He had come from Iraq and what was already being talked about as the Petraeus Doctrine, a shift to a counterinsurgency model. Now, that was the correct strategy, there's no question, but it rested on a very dubious assumption, and that is that the government in Afghanistan would actually govern effectively, that it would provide services and security for its own people down in the localities. What you ended up having to a large degree was government by kleptocracy, you know, various forms of corruption, various forms of cronyism, and so on, rather than something that people would have a stake in. So the strategy wasn't inherently wrong. It's just that you can't go in as a supporting nation, or some would say even an occupying power, and believe you can win the hearts and minds of somebody else's people. They have to do that. And I think that's where President Biden is absolutely correct when he said, the proof is in the pudding. The very nature of the swift collapse of the military and the flight of the government is evidence that no amount of time, resources, and energy was likely to turn the situation around, and that therefore leaving was a good thing, even if no one is going to defend that this has gone smoothly or well, or that it isn't accompanied by a great deal of suffering.
Well, Thomas Mercatus, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I'm happy to do it.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Mercatus, who's a professor of history at DePaul University, who has taught counterterrorism courses for the past 13 years at venues around the world as part of the United States Department of Defense's Counterterrorism Fellowship Program. He's the author of 6 books, including New Terrorism, Myths and Reality, and Violent Extremists, Understanding the Domestic and International Terrorist Threat. And he has an article at The Hill, Afghanistan's Collapse Was Swift, But It Was a Long Time in the Making. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the current pragmatism of the Taliban is not to be trusted. Forget about your house of cards and out of mind. Forget about your house of cards and out of mind. Walk away now. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dr. Sajan Gohel, who is the International Security Director at the Asia Pacific Foundation, who teaches in the Department of International History at the London School of Economics. He has provided in-depth reports on security issues to multilateral organizations such as the European Union, the UNHCR, NATO, OSCE, and Interpol, and is the editor of NATO's Counterterrorism Reference Curriculum. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sajan Gohel.
Good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. And what do you make of the apparent pragmatism, at least on the part of the Taliban leadership? I think there's an inescapable contrast between the assurances that are coming from, they've had a press conference today and they've been on American cable television, their spokespeople, the son of Mullah Omar, Mullah Yaqub, who's the head of the military commission, has said that he's ordered his soldiers not to loot and arrest anybody or go into anybody's house and or steal their car, etc. So is this temporary pragmatism? What do you think?
I would.
Once the Americans go, in other words, will things change?
I would take anything the Taliban says with a huge slab of salt. I am skeptical, dubious about what their genuine, true intentions are. Time will demonstrate. Keep in mind that the Taliban may have changed to a degree in the sense that they've become much more media savvy. They have understood the oxygen of publicity. They know that the best way to get recognition and legitimization is to engage with the international community. So the optics are to talk about gender equality, peace and stability, counter narcotics, not allowing terrorist groups to set up base inside their country. But the reality is that many of these issues that they're talking about don't necessarily reflect what their fighters are actually doing on the ground. There have already been instances in some parts of Afghanistan, places like Ghazni, Mazar-e-Sharif, Kandahar, where women were turned away from universities. There have been stories of kill lists where Taliban fighters have been going from house to house, assassinating people that had served in the Afghan National Army and were in the bureaucracy. And the other two things that I think are very important to mention here is that the narcotics, the heroin, the Taliban have been the biggest dealers of that over the last 20 years. So there is a lot of holes in what they say, and their relationship with Al-Qaeda, I'm afraid, remains totally intact. So that's what I would say. We take everything they say with a huge slab of salt.
And what do you know about their relationship with the ISI, the Pakistani military intelligence?
Well, Pakistan's military establishment, led by its intelligence agency that you mentioned, the ISI, has always had this very murky relationship with the Taliban. They have been accused of having assisted them, trained them, equipped them in the past. That existed pre-9/11 and in many ways post-9/11. Keep in mind that many of the Taliban leaders that we are now potentially going to be seeing on our TV screens, including Mullah Yaqub, who you mentioned, have houses in Pakistan. They have been given safe sanctuary there. Pakistan claims that they only have offered diplomatic support and they try and somewhat dilute their relationship. But it is a very close connection. Keep in mind what Prime Minister Imran Khan said today, and his nickname in some quarters is Taliban Khan. He said that the Taliban victory is a victory against slavery, which was a pretty bizarre remark for him to make.
That is strange indeed. So let's talk a little about then your concerns expressed in an interview at the BBC by their security correspondent, Frank Gardner, where you concerned that the Al-Qaeda will be reconstituted in the new Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan.
Well, much of this is based on the fact that the relationship between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban never ended. It has never been severed. Let's not forget that the Taliban lost control of Afghanistan during Operation Enduring Freedom in the aftermath of 9/11 because they refused to sever and relinquish ties with Al-Qaeda. That just shows you how strong the bond and the connection is. And over time, over generations, what we've seen is members of Taliban families marrying into Al-Qaeda families and vice versa. The other thing that's so important here is the Doha negotiations that took place last year. UN reports have come out with the fact that the Taliban were actually briefing Al-Qaeda as to what those report, or as to what the negotiations in Doha consisted of. And that was happening whilst the Taliban were giving assurances that they would not harbor groups like Al-Qaeda. And what's perhaps even more disturbing is that there are reports that point out that the Al-Qaeda affiliate in the region, Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent, AQIS, its fighters are practically submerged with Taliban fighters, which means they've already been in Afghanistan and are present there. But no one necessarily can tell the difference because they're not wearing separate uniforms.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sajan Gohil, who's an international security director at the Asia Pacific Foundation, who teaches in the Department of International History at the London School of Economics, and he has provided in-depth reports on security issues to multilateral organizations such as the European Union, UNHCR, NATO, OSCE, and Interpol, and is the editor of NATO's Counterterrorism Reference Curriculum. So in terms of the U.S. in Doha, this was, of course, these deals were made by the Trump administration, and Secretary of State Pompeo actually stood there in Doha with the Taliban representative, I think it was Baradar, and he gave us assurances that there would be no presence of Al-Qaeda in the country, and he made a deal with the Taliban. Well, he forced it on the Afghan government, who were not even in these negotiations. They weren't even a part of them. He forced the release of 5,000 battle-hardened Taliban fighters. But that hasn't stopped. I mean, you're in London, Sajan, but I have to tell you that in our incredibly toxic and divided politics in the United States, the Republicans are piling on Biden and blaming him for everything. So I guess not surprising, right?
Well, the consistent element here connecting both the Republican and Democrat parties is the U.S. coordinator for peace and reconciliation in Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad. He was appointed under President Trump, and he was retained under President Biden. And ultimately, this man has to bear the main responsibility for what has transpired and the way it has transpired. Khalilzad has predominantly served in several Republican administrations under Bush, both Bush in senior and junior, as well as in the Reagan administration. And he then also was, as I mentioned, he appointed for this specific role to do with Afghanistan under President Trump. Now, Khalilzad has often moved from position to, on the one hand, where the Taliban are the biggest existential threat on the planet, to that we can negotiate with them, then going back to the fact that they are harboring Al-Qaeda, and then saying, well, we need to talk to our enemies because you don't talk to your friends. And it's this consistent inconsistency that has created the problems today, because the Doha deal was a very flawed arrangement. It was problematic on several levels. It was also based on a premise that one could trust the Taliban. And it did put a lot of pressure on the Ashraf Ghani government. And as you mentioned, 5,000 hardcore Taliban extremists were released. And as soon as they were released, they went and joined the Taliban and fought on the battlefield. Perhaps where the situation was worse subsequently is when President Biden took on this issue, he removed the conditions-based withdrawal, which was partly down to the Taliban stopping the bombing of cities and also having tangible proof that it would sever its ties with al-Qaeda. And again, Khalilzad should have advised President Biden better, and he has to be held accountable for what is now taking place. His position, quite frankly, is untenable.
Well, he's also a Pashtun with close ties to the Pakistanis, so I'm not entirely convinced that he's been a neutral party and there isn't a whiff of Chalabi in there. But nevertheless, just in the last few minutes here, I'd be interested in getting your assessment. You say there are, what, between 250 to 300 al-Qaeda in the country, in Afghanistan, and that the capture of Kunar province has provided them with the kind of terrain in which they can hide, and that the NDS, the Afghan Intelligence Service, has disappeared. So it's going to be very difficult for US and NATO and other intelligence services to get intelligence out of the country. And the other question that you ask in your interview with the BBC is that, you know, how much will the Pakistanis interdict travel of foreign fighters through their territory into Afghanistan? So if you wouldn't mind going through those questions one by one.
The fact that the West will not have a presence on the ground in Afghanistan is going to be harmful and potentially detrimental for counterterrorism operations now. President Biden has spoken about over-the-horizon options, offshore approach, but that is not the same as actually having a presence on the ground, because human intelligence is very much dependent on that. And an offshore approach also then means being dependent on other countries to potentially, say, carry out airstrikes. And that, again, then comes down to the role of Pakistan, because the U.S. will have to rely on countries like Pakistan to enable their bombers, their drones, to travel across their airspace. And if we've seen what's happened in the last 20 years, and let's go even further to prior to 9/11, when the U.S. would be warning the Pakistanis of operations against al-Qaeda fighters, mysteriously, lo and behold, those al-Qaeda fighters ended up disappearing, and the targets suddenly were no longer in the location that the U.S. intelligence was saying. The other thing I would also mention that's relevant here is that even with having a presence on the ground, no one knew that Mullah Omar had died years before the Taliban publicly announced it. So you can imagine just how difficult it's going to be to know what is actually going to be transpiring. And if there is this trust deficit with Pakistan, because keep in mind, President Biden has not spoken to Imran Khan once since he's taken office, I think we've got problems that lie ahead here.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sajan Gohil, who is an international security director at the Asia Pacific Foundation, who teaches in the Department of International History at the London School of Economics, and he has provided in-depth reports on security issues to multilateral organizations such as the European Union, UNHCR, NATO, OSCE, and Interpol, and is the editor of NATO's Counterterrorism Reference Curriculum. Well, of course, the Taliban flag, the white flag with the inscriptions from the Quran on it, is the sort of mirror, negative mirror, I guess, of the ISIS flag, is it not?
There are eerie...
Not the same inscription, but it seems like the positive and negative image.
Well, it's important that you bring up that comparison, because there are eerie similarities here. Both are misogynistic. Both have been involved in criminal enterprise to fill their coffers. They have engaged in human trafficking, and they also are involved in terrorism and collaborate with other terrorist groups. There are a lot of similarities and parallels between ISIS and the Taliban, even if they may have disagreements and turf wars. The ideological doctrine is certainly consistent, and that raises concerns is that if the Taliban can achieve legitimization and recognition, then you are going down a very slippery slope, because we must make sure that women's rights, gender equality, respect for minorities is paramount. The Taliban must not be allowed to get away with taking Afghanistan back to the dark ages, and they will try and do it incrementally. It won't be done all at once like the 1990s. They will try and do it subtly, and it's very important that people around the world, especially women, hold the Taliban account for their misogyny.
So just in the last couple of minutes, Sir John Gohil, on yesterday's program, I spoke with a former CIA officer who was in touch with the people in the Kremlin. Just yesterday, he was talking to people in the Kremlin who were alarmed that the former Soviet states in the south there on the southern border would now be subject to the influence of the Islamic Emirate in Afghanistan, given that this religious fundamentalist revolution. And you can see the fighters that they've interviewed in the streets all say the same thing. They're giddy with power, that they've defeated two superpowers, the Soviets and now the Americans. And they're talking about spreading their influence around the world. Now, obviously, it's hyperbole, but how much should those southern states of the former Soviet Union be concerned that the Taliban will project that sort of religious zeal into those areas?
Well, states that you mentioned, such as, for example, Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, they will have concerns, because if the Taliban allow foreign terrorist fighters to assemble in Afghanistan via Pakistan, that could have detrimental effects, firstly to the region, but then it could have longer repercussions stretching across continents and even on our own doorstep. Because, look, there's a pattern here. Afghanistan in the 1990s became accessible for terrorism, enabling al-Qaeda, resulting in international terrorism, which, of course, 9/11 was the ultimate consequence of. Post-Arab Spring, law and order breaking down in Iraq and Syria. Again, you see the emergence of another group, al-Qaeda in Iraq, transforming into ISIS. International fighters from around the world, terrorism across the world. History, again, could be repeating itself in Afghanistan. It's early right now. It's not going to happen today or tomorrow. It won't, may not even happen at the end of the year. But the seeds of extremism have been replanted in Afghanistan, and they're going to take time for cultivation and growth. But we should watch this space closely, because it is extremely worrying. Unfortunately, we don't have any allies regionally anymore that one can rely on to put this extremism in check.
Well, apparently the Kremlin people told Bob Baer, who had on yesterday's program, that the U.S. was the cork in the bottle. And now that they've left, Russia is nervous.
Well, the Russians seem to be adopting somewhat a paradoxical approach to this, because they may be nervous, but then they seem to be all too willing to recognize the Taliban, and they are probably one of the few countries that have not terminated their diplomatic mission in Afghanistan, along with the Chinese, and the Pakistanis are in fact increasing their mission, unsurprisingly.
Sure. Well, just in closing, do you think that they're welcome to that portfolio?
Well, I think that any...
In other words, buyer's remorse?
Well, I hope that the situation in Afghanistan doesn't spiral out of control to the extent that it will impact, firstly, on women's rights eroding, civil liberties collapsing, the independent media that was one of the great success stories of Afghanistan post 9/11. And then, of course, if all of that deteriorates, extremism will be on the growth. There is a comparison between those elements. And that will have blowback and it will have global repercussions. So if other countries make a mess in the region, it will also have a detrimental impact on us in the UK and also you in the United States.
Well, Dr. Sajan Gohil, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sajan Gohil, who's the International Security Director at the Asia Pacific Foundation, who teaches in the Department of International History at London School of Economics. He has provided in-depth reports on security issues to multilateral organizations such as the European Union, UNHCR, NATO, OSCE, and Interpol, and is the editor of NATO's Counterterrorism Reference Curriculum. We can take a brief station break. We'll be back discussing the devastation caused by Saturday's earthquake, followed by tropical storm in Haiti and the resignation of the judge overseeing the murder trial into the assassination of Haiti's President Moïse.
The newborn in the hammock rocks below a bolted sky that unlocks for the departing of the flocks from the shadow of an empire. God loves a trier, an articulate liar.
Whoop, 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 ga-da-da, whoop, 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 ga-da-da, whoop, 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 ga-da-da, whoop, say, green grass.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Brian Concannon, a human rights lawyer and the executive director of Project Blueprint, which promotes a progressive human rights-based U.S. foreign policy. He is the founder and former director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti and lived in Haiti from 1995 to 2004, where he served as a human rights officer with the United Nations and co-managing attorney with the Bureau des Avocats Internationaux, a public interest law firm. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Concannon.
Well, thank you for having me, Ian.
So a 7.2 earthquake hit Haiti on Saturday, and apparently there's 1,419 dead, 6,000 injured, and 7,000 homes were destroyed and 5,000 damaged, 30,000 families homeless, hospitals, schools, offices, churches, etc., damaged or destroyed. And on top of that, you have Tropical Storm Grace, and people are, you know, out with no roofs on their houses, no tarpaulins, drenched, and they're getting angry. So the pain that this country goes through is just extraordinary and apparently pretty persistent.
Yes, it's unfortunately persistent. And some of this seems to be bad luck in the sense that there hadn't been a major earthquake in Haiti in over 100 years. And now we've had two in the last dozen years. I think that part is bad luck. But I think that a lot of Haiti's vulnerability to disaster isn't natural, but it's the result of man-made forces. And even, you know, if you just look at the 2010 earthquake, because we don't yet have a good idea how many people have died in the most recent one, but Haiti had an earthquake that was much less than contemporaneous earthquakes in both Chile and Japan around the same time. And in both those cases, in Chile and Japan, the earthquakes were multiple times worse in terms of the earth shaking, but they only had a tiny fraction of the death that Haiti had. And that was because they had governments that had been able to provide basic government services that allowed the countries to have some resilience to a disaster. And the problem with Haiti is that even a mild natural stress creates outsized damage because the country is unnaturally vulnerable.
So it finally, of course, in July 7th, I think it was, President Moïse was assassinated. And now we find out that the investigative judge overseeing this investigation, which involves other countries as well, into Moise's assassination, he just quit. Judge Mathieu Chanlat, he recused himself on Friday, just 4 days after being handed the case, and 2 days after one of his court clerks was found dead in a local hospital under circumstances that are fairly suspicious.
Yes, it was pretty evident from the course of the investigation that leading an investigation according to the law and the facts was almost certainly going to be a fatal track for the judge. And this is in the context where you've had a series of politicized attacks against political opponents of the PHT government that President Moïse came from and is still running the country. And that includes a series of gang attacks that Harvard Law School called Crimes Against Humanity. It probably includes the killing of the head of the Bar Association a year ago, reportedly by people connected to the government and for which there has not been an investigation. A judge was, according to the judge's family, was poisoned 4 years ago because he was investigating a case, investigating the government. And if you just look at the current case against President Moïse, from the very beginning, there were efforts to prevent an investigation. The Justice of the Peace, who was supposed to be the first person to respond to the crime to start the investigation, was held away from the crime scene for over 10 hours. You've had other investigators who have received death threats. They've had to go into hiding, and they haven't been getting any government security support. As you mentioned, the investigating judge's clerk was killed under very suspicious circumstances. So you've also had evidence destroyed. You've had arrest warrants issued against people who have no apparent connection to the case but are political opponents of the PHTK party. So if you look at the whole, both the broader context of political violence in Haiti and the narrower context of obstacles to this current investigation, it seems pretty clear that the judge either had to go along with a corrupt investigation that wasn't going to lead to anything, or he needed to resign or do something that was almost certain to get him killed.
And again, I'm speaking with Brian Concannon, a human rights lawyer and the executive director of Project Blueprint, which promotes a progressive human rights-based U.S. foreign policy. He's the founder and former director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti and lived in Haiti from 1995 to 2004. Where he served as a human rights officer with the United Nations and co-managing attorney with the Bureau des Avocats International, a public interest law firm. So given all of what you just told us, Brian, it does feel like this is orchestrated. So to the extent to which there are people in the shadows, powerful people obviously, who simply don't want the truth about who was behind the assassination of Moïse, and as you mentioned, the judge either had a choice to give a phony investigation and come up with whatever fiction they want, and they clearly interested in Henry's government is interested in just burying this whole thing, or the guy would, or the judge would himself be killed, as you've mentioned, a whole bunch of others have. So, who is behind the scenes? I mean, is it the morally repugnant elite, the powerful families of Haitian oligarchs, light-skinned oligarchs who seem to be running Haiti forever, and you know they're holding on to power and wealth in one of the poorest countries in the world, and you just wonder why they're so tenacious.
If you look at almost every troubling political development in Haiti over the last 50 years, probably longer, the economic elites in Haiti are often behind it. They don't have different members of the elite support different political parties, but as a group, they work very well to maintain their control of Haiti's economy and its politics. And it seems likely, I haven't seen any, well, there actually has been, I mean, one of the people that appears to be to be implicated and for which there is, seems to be evidence, is a member of Haiti, one of Haiti's wealthiest families. And other people point to the fact that this was a sophisticated operation that took significant resources and that it could not have been pulled off by the people who have been publicly named. If you looked at, there's a couple Haitian Americans from Florida who've been publicly named, and they were clearly not the type of people with the economic or other capacity to pull something like this off. And instead, it looks like they were just kind of brought in to be the fall guys. And I, that appears to also be the case with the majority of the former soldiers from Colombia who came. It appears that some of them were more deeply involved, but probably that those ones were killed and that the others were just kind of brought in as a way of someone to take the blame. And all that stuff required, as well as the current manipulation of the investigation, all that requires substantial resources. And Haitians are pointing to the elite as one of the few organizations, the few entities in Haiti that have the resources to do that. And at least the Haitians I'm talking to are also pointing to the PHTK party, because they were, you know, they were controlling the apparatus before the assassination, and they're continuing to control the apparatus now. And if they really felt, if the PHTK party really wanted to get to the bottom of who killed the head of their party, the investigation would be going much better than it is. And time and again, when the party apparatus and its leaders have an opportunity to improve the investigation, they have failed to do so.
And again, I'm speaking with Brian Concannon, a human rights lawyer and the executive director of Project Blueprint, which promotes a progressive human rights-based U.S. foreign policy. He's the founder and former director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti and lived in Haiti from 1995 to 2004, where he served as a human rights officer with the United Nations and co-managing attorney with the Bureau des Avocats International, a public interest law firm. So you wonder why, why they're so tenacious. What are they? They're holding on to just power and privilege at the expense of their fellow citizens. Is this just seems so cruel, and you know, I don't even know how you describe it. You know, the idea that this impoverished country just goes through all these horrible natural and unnatural disasters, and the status quo never changes, whether you back to Papa Doc and the Tonton Macoute or this current government under Ariel Henry, who has to be as crooked as they come, because he's clearly a part of all this cover-up. And again, the U.S. seems to always pretend that this, their governments you can deal with. At the same time, they work overtime to stop any really popular government that represents the people from emerging. So can you make the case that the U.S. is in collusion with this morally repugnant elite that have been running Haiti for God knows how long?
Yeah, I think your description of tenaciously holding on to power is an apt one. And I think you're right that the U.S. has a strong connection. And this goes back through at least a century. I mean, the types of people that when Americans go down, and you can see this if you just go to the, you know, to the restaurants of Pétionville, which is kind of where the nice restaurants in Haiti's capital are, you will see people from the embassy, they're not talking with poor dark-skinned Haitians. They're speaking with people who tend to be light-skinned, people who speak English or at least French, who can afford to go out to the nice restaurants. And that is kind of who our contacts, America's contacts in Haiti are these wealthy people. But there's also a much stronger policy connection. The elites have their lobbyists in Washington, so they're able to influence policy through that. They're also always able to control Haiti. And so one of the things that if you are going to be pressing buttons in Haiti, as the U.S. wants to do, it needs to collaborate with the elites. And finally, they do have this common interest in keeping down a progressive popular democracy that, that Haitian voters want. One really important point that that your question raises, Haitians call their country the laboratoire or laboratory. And what they say is that nefarious policies that the US and other countries want to work out, they try them out in Haiti first, and if they work, then they apply them elsewhere. And that came to mind as you were asking the question, because when I first got to Haiti in 1995, I was shocked by this economic elite that was skimming off not just the cream, but all the milk, and leaving the most of the Haitians with nothing. And that meant decreased public services, inability to provide, to access basic health care, education, things like that. And it was revolting. But when you ask that question, it's pretty clear that our country is heading into the same, in the same direction, with a combination of income inequality, decreased public support for, or at least elite support for basic government services, and the consequent undermining of democracy, where now, where, you know, democracy is to a large extent controlled by who has the money. I mean, I think it's always been the case in the United States that people with money have had an outsized influence. But I think if you look over the last 20 years, that has increased remarkably. And Haiti and the U.S. now seems to be heading in the same direction as Haiti.
Well, Brian Concannon, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you very much for covering Haiti.
And again, I've been speaking with Brian Concannon, a human rights lawyer and the executive director of Project Blueprint, which promotes a progressive human rights-based U.S. foreign policy. He is the founder and former director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti and lived in Haiti from 1995 to 2004, where he served as a human rights officer with the United Nations and co-managing attorney with the Bureau des Avocats Internationaux, a public interest law firm. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. One more light goes on.